Hello, my name is Jim Judges. I'm a senior academic technologist at the University of Warwick, and this is the LDCU Talking Online Learning podcast, episode 2. In this episode, I had the pleasure of chatting with three colleagues from Applied Linguistics, and they share information about their pre-sessional English language programme. And this is of particular interest as it ran this summer with well over 1,000 students, and as it had to be transferred from the regular face-to-face model to online delivery this year, it therefore involved even greater use and reliance on technology, as we will hear. I'm with three colleagues from the Applied Linguistics. Oh, here we go. Is it the department?
We are newly created. What's the word? We've been promoted from centre to department. So
That's good. Well, sometimes towns get promoted to city status, yes. Don't they? So this is the equivalent for yourself.
There's no cathedral in our case.
That's right. But one day. So rather than me introduce you, perhaps you could introduce yourselves. Nigel, first of all.
Hello, I'm Nigel Prentice. I've been with Applied Linguistics for many, many years, but I've been more specifically the director of the pre-sessional since 2009.
Thank you. Miriam.
Yes, hi, Jim. Thank you for inviting us to take part in the podcast. My name's Miriam Schwening, and I joined Applied Linguistics in November 2019 from Warwick Foundation Studies. I'm the Assistant Director of Studies on the pre-sessional, and I also work on the in-sessional English language provision, and I work as a teacher trainer.
Thank you, Miriam. And over to you, Penny.
Hello. Yes, my name's Penny Mossavian, and in my main role, I'm Director of Studies in the short course unit at Applied Linguistics, but I'm the outgoing pre-sessional ADOS. I worked on the pre-sessional as Assistant Director of Studies up to last year. In my main role, I work on design and development of bespoke courses for a range of visiting closed groups. So lots of different types of students, teachers, teacher educators, etc. And I've worked at Warwick since 2010.
Thank you. Thanks for introducing yourselves. So for anyone listening, and myself who only knows a little bit about the pre-sessional programme, I know you've all been busy over the summer. Could you say a bit about the programme? Tell us how it's organised and how it ran this summer. Could you start us off, Nigel?
Yes. I mean, I'll tell you about the programme as it's been historically until 2020. Yeah. The pre-sessional programme is a summer course of English language for academic purposes and study skills. And it lasts either 10 weeks or a shorter course of 6 weeks. I should say that 10-week students do continue on into the 6 weeks. And traditionally, the longer programme has involved about 100 students, and the shorter programme, 6 weeks, has been about more recently 700 students. Mostly, overwhelmingly, in fact, postgraduate, international student, and destined for study on postgraduate programmes. And they have usually slightly underachieved on their language entry test. So there's an obligation on the students to follow the course in order to meet their formal language entry requirement for their department. And we give them this program, which starts in mid-July as a general English for academic purposes course. And then in the final 6 weeks, we have a course which is subject specific, so we organize the students into their subject groups, and we the teaching is very closely aligned to their study needs. And I should add that it's a residential course with bringing with it all the administrative issues around that.
Okay, that's interesting then. So previously the students would be on campus and present in the classroom, how was that managed this year, and what happened as a result of the pandemic? Who can say something about that?
Well, I mean, I can introduce in just with a sentence and then hand over to my colleagues, but we started to realize very early in mid-January that we would almost certainly have to go online, and starting with some very early discussions, we had the beginning of planning for a summer online course.
Yeah, so we had to rethink it in quite a major way. We wanted to keep the essence of it, but obviously we realized pretty quickly that it did need restructuring, And one of the main things we had to do was obviously use technology in a very different way. So before we'd been using Moodle, but Moodle had been used by the teachers as a means of supporting the live, the face-to-face classes. Then we realized we had to use Moodle for probably about 50% of the teaching. So that was a form of flipped learning approach that we took. So the students did the Moodle activities, and the Moodle activities were a form of self-study, obviously, highly interactive. We used H5P quite a lot to try and keep the engagement up. And then once the students had done that particular set of activities, they had live sessions, and for the live sessions, we used Teams. And we wanted to keep the quality of the course. So we wanted quite a low teacher student ratio.
Yes.
So we had 1 to 12. So one tutor per 12 students. And we had classes of that size.
What was your involvement then, Penny? And can you say a bit about how things were structured from your point of view and how it differed from previous years?
Yes. Well, obviously, we had to change the format. As Miriam has said, we had to change the format of the course quite a lot. I mean, it had grown into quite a large course. When last year was our highest numbers, we were just over 700 students and a teaching team of just over 60. We knew quite early on that we couldn't just move that face-to-face course online. Apart from anything else, the nature of the course that we had delivered up to this point was we got 4 weeks of fairly generic academic skills teaching and then dividing up into subject specific groups. And it was quite obvious that we wouldn't be able to do that. We had to kind of make the course generic across the board, because we had so many teachers active online all at the same time. So we had to be very careful about what that course comprised. And of course, the 94 classes and the 94 teachers will all be using the same resources as well. So we had to make it as accessible as possible.
Miriam, did you want to say something?
Yeah, just the way that we... The course content was organised, this wasn't a course where we had existing material and we changed existing material to make it an online content. What we did was we wrote an online course.
Yeah.
So it wasn't sort of taking existing lectures and recording them.
Could you say something about the overall structure of the course and the timetable for the student, Nigel?
Well, yes, we've had a generally traditional division into reading writing skills and listening speaking skills, and we kept that division and carried it over into our course in 2020. And in practice, we had, following the Moodle work which the students did in their homes, they would come to their live sessions for 1 hour of listening speaking and 1 hour of reading writing per morning. And I say per morning, I mean UK time morning.
Yep.
In practice, that worked very well for the majority of our students who were from China. They were coming to us in their early evenings.
Okay, so can you just say something about how the day was structured and how you managed the groups in Moodle and in Teams?
Yeah, so we had the students had 5 hours of course content a day. 3 hours of that was studying the material on Moodle. And that was mainly in H5P. And then that was followed by 2 hours of synchronous lessons via Teams. So there was a very strong link between the material that was in Moodle and the material then that was in Teams. And how it was organized was that we had a Moodle area. We had forums within Moodle about 12 to 15 students. So we had 94 groups in Moodle. And those same groups were migrated across to separate Teams areas, which formed the classrooms. So in effect, we had 94 classrooms for each, and each teacher had their own room.
But it's interesting just to observe that you were early adopters of the Teams technology and you're using it on a big scale. So can I ask you now how it went, and technology wise, what worked well, what were the challenges? And then perhaps we can talk about some of the lessons learned. So there must have been some significant challenges. Do you want to start us off there, Penny?
Well, I can certainly talk to you about some of the early challenges, particularly in terms of what we were going to use. I mean, we knew that we were going to be using Moodle. That was definite from the word go. But we spent quite a few weeks thinking that we were going to be able to use Zoom. And there was this whole early conversation about Zoom security versus Teams security. And it wasn't until we were quite a long way into our planning that we were told that, in fact, we would be required to use Teams. By that point, we had actually run the first digital skills audit with the teachers. And we weren't really asking about Teams per se, for the live classes specifically I'm talking about here. So we then had to kind of not backtrack, sidestep, I think is probably a fairer description, and run a second digital skills audit to identify teachers who were already familiar with delivering live teaching on Teams. So that was sort of like one of the challenges of early adoption, if you like, was the fact that we were vacillating between the use of Teams and Zoom.
A big challenge. Yeah, sorry for interrupting. There must have been significant training overhead, or am I right that you had to get your tutors up to speed on that, Miriam?
Yeah, that was a really big challenge for us, and we realised it quite early on. That through our digital skills audit, that a lot of teachers had experience using Zoom. So we were initially very happy and thinking, oh, well, OK, this isn't going to be too difficult. Great. They were using Zoom for their lessons. And then we, on the second digital skills audit, we realized we had about 6 teachers who had used Teams for teaching and about 10 who had ever used Teams at all. So the implications of that were fairly major, and it was a worry for us. What we did was we had training from the academic technologists, which was very good, and they were able to show us and advise us on how to use Teams, and did some training with our teachers on what Teams was. But we also did some training using IT skills audit, in which we identified which teachers had got experience using Teams for teaching and organized subgroups. Sort of we organized groups around so some peer training, and we were lucky enough also to work with Darren Board, who was able to produce some excellent how-tos for us on using the Teams technology specifically for the EAP type teaching.
And EAP?
EAP, English for Academic Purposes, where we don't generally give lectures.
Yes.
So it was a very different type of teaching, I suppose, to a lot of teaching that goes on where it is lecture-based. This is a skill, learning yes. skills, and that is through practice. Which is why we used a lot of H5P.
Okay.
So you mentioned breakout rooms, and I realised that was a big part of how you worked with your students. Could you say a bit more about that?
That was one of our big concerns, with the fact that Teams didn't offer that breakout room facility, but rather inventively, and with the help of the Teams team, we set up tables. And in fact, what we did was we kind of trial ran everything with the Teams training team, and set ourselves up as students to try those tables out so that we knew exactly what we would be asking our teachers to do.
Now, sorry to interrupt. Can I just ask you, when you say tables, so there you're reproducing the idea or replicating the idea in the classroom, is that right? Where students would go
yes.
to a different yeah. table.
Yes. Yeah.
And this, therefore, was a different channel in your team, presumably.
Yeah. I'll say something about that. We had to really pare down the classroom. So we had a very basic Teams classroom with just one general channel and these other channels that were our tables. So we really had to minimize it. We didn't use OneNote. We didn't complicate it. We kept it very, very basic and allowed teachers to gain confidence with the with just the plenary. We used the general channel for giving plenaries, and then we used the other channels, which we called tables, for going to small group work.
So you mentioned a little bit about the use of forums. Can you say how they used and how they contributed to what the students were doing?
Yeah, so forums in Moodle were integral really to the course and very important because they allowed us to gauge student engagement as well. So there were activities within the Moodle area where they were instructed to answer in the forums. So we had activity forums. And then the teachers gave feedback on their posts and students were encouraged to do peer feedback as well. So one of the assessments during the tutorials was to assess their ability to critique other students' work, which I thought was really nice. So that worked well.
Thanks for that, all of you. And no doubt a steep learning curve for everyone, although presumably bearing in mind that we carry on to make significant use of these tools, that presumably yourselves and your tutors will hopefully have benefited from developing their confidence and expertise in using these tools. But could I ask you, knowing what you know now, is there anything that you would have changed, or was it just you had to get on with it and learn as you went? Is there anything, Nigel, you might do differently or feed into next time?
Well, I think Miriam will elaborate on this, but we all agree, I think, that we would prepare and train and inform our tutors infinitely better before they come to actually start teaching. And in practice in 2020, a lot of things we didn't know about, I think. It surprised us and we had to react very quickly.
Yes.
I think, Miriam, you probably would want to expand on that.
Yeah, I think in the lead up to the course, we spent a lot of time preparing the course material and the course content. And that was a major concern for us, that it was coherent and worked well. So the actual logistics of things like how are assessments going to work? What about tutorials? These things that we dealt with as they, you know, in the week before they were happening. So we were constantly feeding our teachers with new information, new challenges. And that was good in a way because Teams allowed us to get a response from our teachers before. So we could adapt the material before it went out to students. So it was a very sort of bottom up process, which was really nice. And I think now we've got that and we have the input from the 94 teachers, whoever wanted to give us feedback, we can now use that to prepare a website where all that information is given to them in advance so they can do the standardization activities before the course starts. They know about the moderation of the of assessments and the logistics of running live assessments, and that all that information is given to them in a website beforehand, so they're not sort of having to think on their feet all the time and respond very quickly. And they were very flexible in terms of how they dealt with all this new information.
Think about the technology. You mentioned one or two tools that some staff perhaps use, like polling, and perhaps different tutors perhaps use different tools. Do you have any technology tips or advice for anybody who perhaps is doing something similar or might even be thinking about how they engage students online and how they keep them interested? Did you have anything to say on that, Penny?
My main tip for developing this type of teaching, if you like, is to keep the live sessions as simple as possible.
Yeah.
And then once teachers are confident in that area, yes, by all means, use some of the Teams apps that are available.
And I'll come to yourself, Miriam, in a second. And Nigel, how about yourself coordinating and managing such a large program? Is there anything any tips and advice?
Well, the irony for me is that most of my colleagues were having a great time learning a lot about this new technology, and I was doing some of the administrative and bureaucratic tidying up behind the scenes. We had enormous problems onboarding students, enrolling students, but I think these are administrative issues rather than specifically Moodle and Teams. The only broad reflection I would make is, of course, it is worth stressing that our course is very much a language course, and language involves skills, as Miriam said earlier, and some of our experiences and our practices perhaps don't apply to a more content-based academic program. But Penny's point about keeping the live classes simple is a good one.
Yeah, Miriam, are there any technology tips or advice that you might have from lessons learned?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's important. We have this great opportunity now to reassess pedagogies that we might have thrown out in face-to-face teaching. And it is a wonderful opportunity to look again at things. For example, we chose the flipped classroom, and I think a lot of departments are going for the flipped classroom approach now, and where it maybe didn't work face to face, we're finding that we can really use it now and it can work very well. And I think with lots of departments using it and it becoming a norm, that would be a great thing, and students can be more independent. And so I would say reassess pedagogies that maybe you didn't think work before and use it as an opportunity to experiment.
Just think about student engagement. Can you say anything about how you managed to get students interested and engaged?
It was one of our concerns, really, that students might not engage fully in the asynchronous material, because that had been our experience in face-to-face teaching, that you do flipped classroom and half the students turn up and they haven't done it and your whole session falls apart. So we did put things in place for that. So things we did was we made the Moodle material highly interactive and attractive. So we used H5P, we used lots of images, we used lots of variety, videos and different types of activities for our asynchronous material. We planned weekly tutorials to discuss engagement with the students and to grade their levels of engagement in the tutorials, both for the Moodle material and for the classroom. So they were given a grade at the end of each week and how they performed for engagement. And that information was passed on to receiving departments because we felt it was an important piece of information for departments that were also going to have a substantial amount of asynchronous content. And they needed to know that their students had the maturity to deal with that and to apply themselves and that self-discipline.
And finally, I asked about the differences between face-to-face and online learning and if they had any preferences for the different modes of delivery.
I think you'd have three different answers there.
Go on then. Go on,
Nigel. I'll stick my neck out first. And that is because I know the course so well and I taught on it myself for many, many years. I absolutely prefer a classroom environment, a real live classroom environment, and the engagement, if you like, with real kind of walking students, who walk past your office.
Yes.
But the only proviso to that, I'd say, is that we've written such a good course, such a good generic EAP course, that I'd like to think we can find a way of somehow or other bringing it in, perhaps at an early stage of a pre-sessional course. Perhaps there's a pre-sessional or something.
Okay, yeah. And do you have thoughts on that, Miriam?
Yeah, I would say giving the students the choice would be very useful. What we found with the online course was that students could focus on the academic content and on the learning probably a little bit better than they could when they're on campus, because when they arrived on campus at first they're hit with the whole culture shock, all the diversions of how do I get my shopping, oh my goodness, I've never cooked for myself before, and all that. Of course, their life skills and they're important, but It did mean that without that, them having to deal with those, they were able to really focus on the academic side of it. And I don't know if, Nigel, you would agree with that.
No, I take that point.
Yeah. So to give them a choice, I would say.
Yeah. Well, choice would be interesting. It certainly sounds like you were able to broaden your reach in terms of numbers and scale, perhaps. But Penny, any comments on that?
Well, although I thought there might be three different answers, I have to concur with Miriam. I think there's a lot of scope for the online pre-sessional to offer students a deeper engagement with the academic content. We do find that when students arrive, they are distracted. So I think, you know, that blended approach can be developed and built upon, really.
What are you involved in now, and what happens next, Nigel? Do you put your feet up and relax until next summer, or what happens in your department?
To some extent, yes. But I do a bit of straightforward teaching of my own in the coming term, certainly. There's a big question around what will happen next summer. And because pre-sessional is part of the general process of admission of students, there will have to be a decision taken fairly soon about what kind of course we deliver next summer. So that's very much an open question.
And Penny, what about yourself? What are you involved in at the moment? What's next?
Well, I've moved back to my role with short courses. And of course, now having spent the past 4, 5, 6 months working on pre-session, I've now got fantastic experience to take forward and adopt for our short course programming. And very, very lucky that I don't like to call it a template. It doesn't seem right to call it just a template, but the pre-sessional that we have now is a fantastic resource for all of the short courses going forward, because it's so rich in content and activities that we can pick and choose really how we put our short courses together. And that's what we're doing at the moment. We're talking to all sorts of closed groups from around the world who want the academic training, and now we have something that's almost ready made.
How about you, Miriam? What are you working on?
So I'm working similarly with Nigel, the same as on the in-sessional English for Academic Purposes. And I think we're kind of using the pre-sessional model to structure that. And we're working together with Gerard Sharpling on that.
So thank you very much for your time this afternoon. I've enjoyed finding out all about your programme. Thanks for sharing that.
That's my pleasure, Jim. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes, thank you, Jim. It was good to talk about it again and to reflect on it. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Jim, for asking us. And good luck to everybody adopting their teaching and learning in the same way.
So that's it for this second bumper edition of this LDCU podcast. Thanks again to contributors Nigel Prentice, Penny Mossavian and Miriam Schweening. And my name is Jim Judges. If you have something to share related to the world of online learning at Warwick, or know someone who does, then please do get in touch. I'm keen to hear from as many different voices and colleagues from across Warwick University, and I'd be happy to carry out an interview sometime soon. I should reward anyone that's made it this far with a podcast fact. Did you know it's 20 years to the month since in October 2000 when Tristram Lewis and Dave Weiner developed the concept of attaching video and audio to an electronic subscription service, or RSS, and the podcast was born. And here we are 20 years later. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening.